We talk a lot on this podcast about chess improvement, but when it comes to improving your hiring processes, Indeed is the platform you need. Indeed has over 350 million global monthly visitors, and it has a matching engine that helps you find quality work candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with your candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Years ago, when I was running a chess teaching business, I found it hard to find good help, and I had to go through a lot of back and forth to even screen potential candidates. Indeed allows you to do those things efficiently in one place. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed for hiring, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of Perpetual Chess will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility if you go to Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now, and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast, Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. We have another guest I have long wanted to speak with who will be joining us shortly. But before we introduce him, I did want to give a shout out to our presenting chess education sponsors, Chessable.com. Some of their new courses include Fundamental Chess Calculation by recent guest, candidate master Ken Kabadayi. And Sam Shanklin is out with his latest in his Neo-Catalan series, Neo-Catalan Volume 3. Sam, of course, is rightfully always a popular regular author, Chessable author, and we are excited for that one. So I'll link to those as well as to some of my all-time Chessable favorites and appreciate their support as always. As for our guest this week, he is a journalist, a dad, and the author of the brand new book co-authored with Grandmaster Jakob Augard called Endgame Labyrinths. It's available obviously in book form, also on Forward Chess. It goes deep into the topic of endgame studies, which is fitting because our guest, in addition to being a strong amateur player with a peak FIDE rating in the 2200s, is a world champion chess study composer. He's an IM of FIDE for chess compositions and has been winning all kinds of plaudits for his creative tactical studies and an expert in the field. And obviously, I've interviewed a lot of people who mention solving studies as an improvement tool over the years, but I have never interviewed someone, well, with the possible exception of Jan Timman, who is accomplished in many realms, I've never interviewed someone with such a specialized focus in chess studies and so many achievements in chess study composition. So I am pleased to welcome to the program Stefan Slumstrup Nielsen. Welcome, Stefan.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, excited to have you. And I've been digging into the book. It is so many beautiful endgame studies in it, extremely challenging. So I would definitely caution listeners, don't purchase it expecting to solve every puzzle. But I mean, I don't even know if you call them puzzles. To me, they still do qualify as puzzles. And we'll dig into that in time, Stefan. But I thought for starters, it might help frame the conversation if we heard about how you got into this sort of rabbit hole within the rabbit hole of chess, of chess study composition?
It's a good question. I think I already had the interest when I was a teenager. But at that point, I loved playing the competitive game as well. And then at some point, I realized that I was never going to become a GM or even an international master. And I started making these mini puzzles in the beginning without a computer. I showed it to my club mates and they said, okay, this is hideously cooked, this problem. You show us. Then I went back and tried to improve it. And then I got a computer. And then from then on, I spent a lot of my spare chess time making these puzzles or in game studies without ever submitting them to tournaments or publishing them in any ways. It was like that for maybe 10 years. And then eventually I got the idea to submit one of these studies to a tournament. And that's how I got started.
Okay. And for listeners, cooked basically means that there's like a faulty solution. There's only one linear path to an answer, but it turns out either the answer is wrong or there's multiple solutions. Is that the correct definition, Stefan?
Yeah. If it's cooked, it's you cannot meet the stipulation. If it's if there's a dual, that means that there are more than one solution, and that doesn't work either, of course.
Yeah, so yeah. All kinds of guidelines and rules, and in the book, mm-hmm. then Stefan and Jakob also get into sort of different tactical themes and mm-hmm. different elements that people find pleasing about endgame studies. And just so that we can sort of start at the broadest level for anyone who hasn't gotten into this world, how would you define an endgame study, Stefan?
It's a chess puzzle where you have to either win or draw. It's always white to move. White has to find a way to the win the position. It will normally say white to move and win. And then you as a solver will have to find the path for white to win. And it doesn't mean win in two or three or four moves. It means to win eventually. So you have to prove a win in all against all black defenses, basically.
Okay, yeah. And in the book, you write that your aim when you go to compose a study is for it to be artistic and accessible. Is that is that something that you've come to over time, or was that sort of your aim from the beginning when you describe sort of just tinkering on your own?
In the beginning, I wanted it to be artistic, basically, to make something that's exciting and interesting and new. So I remember very clearly the first major study that I worked on. I had an idea of two black pawns about to promote, both on the second rank, and white had bishop and two bishops and a rook, and they somehow kept checking the black king, so black was never allowed to promote, and then in the end, white won. And this was like a complicated idea to begin with, but for me it was all about artistry, and I didn't consider anyone trying to solve it because it was very difficult.
Sorry, go ahead.
That was the first study, but after that, I've opened my eyes more to the solving part of the studies, trying to think about what a good chess player would think in this position, and then try to find another solution than that, find a paradox or something.
Yeah, and it's kind of hard to describe on audio format, but basically there's a lot of sort of very creative, unexpected moves, and often like that move might even just be a pit stop on the way to another solution or to an even sort of greater creative or unexpected move. You did an interview with Satanic Mukuti, sorry, Satanic, from Chess Base India, where you walked through sort of getting the inspiration from this Daniil Dubov game and then kind of working to make something more, even more pleasing to the eye than this nice combination that Dubov played. And I found that to be a helpful exposition. Now, you mentioned, Stefan, that you initially weren't even working with engines when you started to sort of try to create studies. Obviously, engines have taken over in terms of calculation prowess. So what's your approach now as it relates to engines as you're trying to compose something?
I always sit up with the computer or the phone when I compose now. I never use a board anymore. But there are two ways to use engines or computers. That's the way where you sit, probably sit with the chess base and the Stockfish running, and you have an idea and you want to see if the idea is correct, if there's only one solution. So normally when I sit with chess base, I show four variations, the four best moves. So I put up a set up a position, and then I see, okay, white wins in with the best move, and the other moves are not enough. So I use this tool all the time to check, and then I see, okay, this is still not interesting enough. So I add some pieces, and I check again, and I add some more pieces, and I shift some pieces, and I move them around to make my idea work. And I use this engine for checking. That's the one way to use computers. The other way is to mine the table bases, which means you look for certain positions in the Nalimov and table bases, the 7-piece table bases. That is, you can make a search, for instance, for all positions with 5 pieces where white wins only by playing his bishop from a8 to h1, for instance, or something very specific, and then you get a printout saying these are the 10 positions where this move works, and you see if there's something interesting in there. That's the other way to use computers.
And you do both?
No, I don't. I only use, for now, I'll say I only use the first method.
Okay.
Because I'm not a computer expert in any way, and I really like the process of finding these things myself, to be honest.
Yeah,
but some of my fellow composers, they are into this mining, and it's interesting and fascinating as well. It's just another way to make studies.
And Stefan, you mentioned in another interview you have a family. So part of the reason that maybe you've gravitated more towards study composition than OTB competition is that you can do it for little bits at a time. You don't have to leave the house. You mentioned doing it on commutes. So I'm curious, if you're working on it away from home, are you turning the engine on in the phone, or is that more sort of a brainstorming situation?
No, that's Stockfish app as well.
Okay. But as you mentioned, computers weren't as dominant when you started. So when did you start to work basically exclusively with engines as you work to compose these beautiful puzzles?
From the moment I submitted my first study, I used the computer all the time. It's just maybe even back in the 90s, in the very beginning when I tried to get these ideas that I didn't use a computer. And then when I submitted the first study in 2011, from that point, I've used computers.
Okay. And do you personally, as a obviously someone who composes so many amazing studies, also consumes a lot, what are you drawn to as a study solver or chooser?
Mm-hmm. It's such a complicated question because I'm drawn to a lot of stuff. But what I like, because I'm not a grandmaster, I like clarity. I like a position where I understand the solution and I understand why only one road to the goal works. But at the same time, I want to be surprised by this path. So I like surprise, and I like special effects, if you can say that.
Okay.
Some shocking moves, taking your rook from f1 to f7, where it can be captured by 3 black pieces. I like this effect, but the variations at the same time, they need to be short and understandable for players of my level and even below my level.
And so again, peak rating in the 2200s, so certainly a very strong amateur player, but I can certainly relate to what you're saying about you reaching a moment where you realized you were not going to be an IM or a GM. But do you feel like calculation?
It certainly was a question of talent, but also a question about endurance and focus and being willing to sacrifice a lot of stuff. Because I was never that type of player who was very ambitious. In fact,
yeah, it just takes so much work. Mm-hmm. And when you're given a study, if you're presented one, do you immediately try to solve it, or do you kind of look at the contours? I'm just curious, as someone who's obviously, even before this book, seen so many. And of course, you mentioned going through the famous Endgame study database with Grandmaster Agard to select the material for Endgame Labyrinths.
Mm-hmm. If someone posts a study that I don't know on Twitter or Facebook, I try to solve it for maybe a couple of minutes. But I'm also a very lazy solver, to be honest. And I think the readers of the book, they need to be anything but lazy. And I'm very quick at checking with the computer for the solution because I'm most of all curious to know the solution, to know what's special about this position. What is the how does it stand apart from other similar positions? So it's very much about exceptions and paradox.
Yeah. And I can relate to that as well. We should say sort of the top line goal of the book, and maybe you could explain, you could expound on this better than I can. But basically, you and Grandmaster Agard, as Agard writes in the intro, sort of tooled around with various endgame studies and then wanted something that sort of compiled the best and sort of the most helpful for improvement. Is that an accurate description?
That's true. And the one that are most useful for practical usage. Okay. Not the artistically best studies, but the most the best and the most useful studies.
Okay. Yeah. And I do want to echo what you were saying. I took a similar approach when I was reading the book. I, of course, read all the prose, but yeah, when it came time to study, I my chess ambition, as like you, was probably never strong enough to get me to a higher level, and certainly isn't strong enough now. So, but the way I consume the book is one that I still would recommend and consider worthwhile, especially because the material is so challenging that you can just get it on Forward Chess, spend a minute or so sort of brainstorming, and then sort of play the solution. And there's so many creative solutions that are pleasing to the eye. That even if you like us old dads, you're not super ambitious, you can still enjoy it. When we come back, we will hear Stefan's thoughts and a quote from Grandmaster Jakob Agard on how helpful solving endgame studies is for your chess improvement. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
And we are back. Do you have a philosophy about how helpful solving endgame studies, or an opinion, I should say, how helpful it is for chess improvement?
I have an opinion that is very useful, but I have no way to prove it. No one ever made any study of this, I think. But I think it must help for pattern recognition, knowing all these stalemate patterns, all these positions where a passed pawn is unstoppable, because even against maybe a bishop and a knight who are somehow helpless to stop the pawn, there are hundreds or even thousands of these patterns that are shown in endgame studies in artistic form, and you need to know these. And I think even especially now when there's this short time control, knowing these patterns, knowing to when there's a stalemate on the horizon, instinctively knowing that now is the moment you need to find the correct, precise way to draw or to win. That's what you learn from studies.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I'll share what Grandmaster Agard, and of course, obviously this topic has come up repeatedly on the podcast when I recently interviewed Anna Zatonsky, and she mentioned sort of redoubling her efforts getting ready for the Cairns Cup. She said that what she did to get ready for the tournament was solve endgame studies for hours a day, every day. There's been plenty of other trainers. David Howell talked about how they were formative for him as a kid. Melik Kachin, I know, is a big fan in both his own study and his training materials. So, of course, there's legions of devotees, although also one or two, I don't know if I'd call them naysayers, but there is sort of the knock that sometimes they can be impractical because, as you say, you like something with like a tidy solution. Chess over the board doesn't work that way. So that's a long preamble to Grandmaster Agard's quote, which I will read. And sorry, and Stefan, and then feel free to chime in. So Grandmaster Agard writes, solving difficult exercises enters into the scene when you make a push past the local scene and start to compete in international tournaments. For this, endgame studies can be highly useful. The requirement of having one narrow path to the podium is actually less unrealistic for the practical player's experience than one would think. But even if it was, then training is meant to isolate the improvement of specific skills, not mimic practical play in its entirety. That's called playing. So I found that insightful, but sorry, you were going to say something?
No, I forgot what I was going to say.
Okay. Yeah. Again, different opinions may vary, and people want to focus on what they enjoy as well. But certainly it has to help your calculation skill to solve these difficult puzzles repeatedly. Do you feel like calculation was a strength of yours? I mean, I know you're still playing some league games, so I guess I should say, is a strength of yours as a player, Stefan?
You should say it was.
Was? Sure. Okay.
Yeah. I think I was pretty good at calculation. I was very poor at opening play. So I believe my style was, I was basically a swindler when I used to play. I got into bad positions, that my positional play was not good, and I liked unstructured position and unbalanced positions, so I can trick my opponent to basically. It's not entirely true because I know some positional play as well, and my endgame was particularly weak. I can tell you, I always told my teammates that I would never enter an endgame unless I was at least two pawns up, because I knew I would mess it up, because my practical endgame was very weak. I think it was a lack of energy, to be honest, or persistence in keep playing the best moves in time pressure. I got nervous, I think, mostly in endgames, and I'm not even sure if I had enough knowledge.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Because there's the dichotomy in endgames where, like, people who are strong positional players who might have a sense for sort of the harmony of chess pieces can excel at endgames. Yeah. But there's also the brute force calculation that can come into play, the fewer pieces on the board. So I can get what you're saying, especially as it relates to stamina, with maybe not being great at the first aspect. But as you've dove into the world of endgame studies, it strikes me that you would be strong at the calculation side of things.
I probably would, but I don't play enough now to have any way to prove it. I believe I won my last four games, but it's been 4 years playing these four games. So I don't play a lot anymore.
So you were playing in a league in Copenhagen, is that correct?
Now I play my games in Copenhagen.
Okay.
When I was a top player at my top peak rating, I played in the Danish National Best League.
Okay.
But that was it.
And did you make a conscious decision to stop playing that?
No. I got less interested in over the board play. I got a family. I started with studies. I know for a fact that I started composing my first major study in 2007, and I recently checked, and that was the exact moment my rating peaked. So it doesn't really support the idea that endgame studies helped your over the board play, because the moment I started going into endgame studies, my rating went down.
Maybe you had the engine on too much.
Yeah, probably.
And how many hours a week, Stefan, would you say? I mean, obviously this book has been a project of immense magnitude, but preceding the book, how many hours would you say you were spending composing?
Maybe 7 hours a week.
Okay, that's not crazy. Yeah. That's a healthy
habit.
No, it's
not crazy. But maybe it's more like 14, to be honest. I mean, every quiet moment with my phone, I would say I'm probably working on some sort of idea. And I'm not the type of composer who gets an idea and then keeps working on it until it's done. I have maybe 150 studies in a PDN file on my computer, half-baked ideas that are waiting to become real. So I use 5 minutes here on one study, 5 minutes on the other. And then at some point I realize, okay, this is going to be good. I'll finish it. I'll submit it somewhere.
And what does your family think of this hobby?
Well, my youngest daughter is 2.5. I think she doesn't care.
sounds about right.
My wife is a bit older, and I think she's believes it's a bit too much. I mean, I'm not at the club playing at night.
Right.
I'm at home, so that's good. But perhaps I spend too much time on my phone on the studies for sure, and especially with three kids. So.
And when you won the world championship, did that change either your calculus or her calculus? How did that feel?
No, it changed nothing, because it's. I mean, that's the great part about studies. There's all these discussions now about influencers and money in chess, but we know for a fact that a study composer, that there's no money to be had in our business. So even as a world champion, it doesn't really change anything. It's a title. She was surprised, I think. I knew she knew I had a chance, but she was surprised. But it's a hobby. It's a fantastic hobby. It's the best. But
yeah, I watched your talk on there's a talk you give on YouTube presenting some of your studies, and you talk about sort of what gets engagement on social media in terms of the way puzzles are presented versus what makes a good endgame composition study. Obviously, the examples you gave were helpful, but in sort of a more audio accessible format, could you sort of describe that push and pull?
The difference between a puzzle and a study.
Yeah, like, so what makes a good endgame study compared to what's likely to get a lot of clicks on Instagram or Twitter?
For one thing, a typical endgame study is more difficult than the average position put on Facebook and Twitter. That's one thing, and there are a lot of combination exercises on Facebook where. You know, there's a white rook on h1, it goes to it's sacrificed, and then the queen comes and checkmate in four moves or something like that. That's a typical combination that's shown on Facebook or Twitter. But this tactical motif, these typical attacking motifs, they've been seen 100,000 of times. So as a composer, you need to do a little more. You need to make a spectacular move with white, for instance, and then black has to counter this with a spectacular move of his own, and then play has to continue from there. The tension has to remain for more than a couple of moves, and both white and black must play actively. That is one of the mantras of the best composer now and probably forever, Oleg Pavakov from Russia, that endgame studies must be a battle between black and white, and black has to be creative as well. It's not a forcing sequence. It's a full blown battle of ideas.
That's beautiful. And when you think, so you've mentioned you've won a couple prizes for your studies. Did you, in looking back at them, do you actually look at them as better than your others? Or do you just think there's, as you've mentioned, it's artistic. Do you just think that those sort of happen to win?
Normally, when you get a prize, the studies are better than your average studies. But judges are human. Mm-hmm. And it's typically in a tournament, there's one judge who says, okay, this is the best study, this is the next best, and so on. But it's his or her opinion. And there are not a lot of rules for judges to judge by. So if you want to compare it with anything in the sporting world, it's I think it's artistic skating.
Figure skating.
Yeah, figure skating, exactly. Figure skating, where, of course, they have some rules to go by. They have something to measure the difficulty of the tricks. But a lot of this is individual as well. So you cannot automatically say that a study that won a major prize is a very good study, because judges make mistakes or just have different opinions.
Okay. And when you do make a study that won a prize, like we talked about how much time you spend per week, but to make a study that you're proud of, how much time would have gone into that particular study on average?
I cannot tell you exactly how many hours I spent on the study, but I say that most of my best studies it's been half an year, at least half a year from the start moment. Wow. I began to the moment I finished it, because I spent time on other projects and other studies as well. I returned to it. I say, okay, this is a promising position, but it's not the perfect setting yet. And I can tell you that the very first study that I worked on, it's a really funny story, actually. That was when I started composing. I hadn't submitted anything to any tournament yet, but I made this, and I started working at it in 2006. And I know for a fact that I showed my friend a version of it in 2007, because I remember this trip and I showed him this position. I worked on it some more. And I know that I submitted this study in 2011 to a tournament held for the London 2012 Olympics, the real Olympics, not just IOC Olympics. And this study that I finally managed to send, and I really liked my very first study, it was not awarded by the judge. The judge didn't like it. He's just ignored it in his prize giving. So you can spend 5 years and still get nothing, I can assure you.
How did that feel? I mean, were you upset?
It was awful. Like, I remember really waiting for this award. I checked my email even, you know, to see when it came, because that's normally how you receive awards, or checked websites, and then it was there, and I was not mentioned.
Did that make you have any second thoughts? Like, why? Like, what am I doing with my
apparently
time?
Apparently not, because at that, well, it's hard to tell, because at that moment I already sent my second study for the Jan Timman 60th Jubilee Tournament, and that was my breakthrough study. That was the first very good one, and I won that tournament. So I cannot tell you if that had fallen as well, if I would have given up at that moment. Could be.
Yeah, I mean, obviously. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, but no, I can't believe it, because I always had this interest in chess curiosities. I was an eager reader of Tim Kappe's blog that is still there, but maybe not active anymore. With all his, there were a lot of studies there as well, but other also crazy game fragments. So I always loved this part of fun in chess. So I don't think I would have stopped even.
Yeah, for listeners not familiar, Tim Kappe has an old blog called Chess Curiosities that has endgame studies, but also has tons of other sort of, you know, best games, best checkmates, so on and so forth. And yeah, last updated in 2022. I, of course, have a chess newsletter where I gather the chess news, and I have a long list where I check sites every week to make sure nothing's updated. So I still check Tim Kappe every week just in case. Yeah. Listeners,
it's sad that he stopped. I think he's now into maybe writing novels or about cycling, or I don't know.
Yeah, I did interview him about 2 years ago, and yeah, he was working on pushing out another novel. So, yeah. So it's understandable. And to what I was asking you about, sort of, and I want to get back to your winning composition in the Timman competition in a second, but to what I was asking you about whether you felt deflated after working for 5 years and being really proud and not winning a prize. I mean, every chess player has moments where they're thinking of just quitting chess, like after a tough loss or whatever it may be. So quitting composition, obviously, I would expect nothing different. But I'm glad that, I mean, it's good that you persevered and got some positive feedback. So obviously, Jan Timman is probably the most famous over the board chess study composer aficionado. Of course, there have been people like Smyslov in past eras and many others. Did you meet Timman when you competed in the contest named for him?
No, I didn't. I wrote shortly with him, but at that time I didn't meet him. I met him twice afterwards at the ExtraCon Open in Helsingør in Denmark, where he played, and I went to see the games.
Okay. Did you get to chat with him?
Yeah, we showed each other studies for maybe 1.5 hours. Yeah. It was amazing. It was, I mean, he wanted to see my studies, so I was okay.
That's
great. He's a very great man, big name.
Yeah.
Proud.
And
he also wanted to show his studies to me. And like a child, like, look what I made. And I couldn't believe that I was sitting opposite world champion candidate.
Yeah. Yeah. Amazing. And in that sort of environment where you're talking with one of your colleagues and sort of bouncing ideas off of each other, when they show you a study, like, how long are you going to sit there and try to solve it?
Me personally, I would like to start by solving. So at least spend 5-10 minutes when you're sitting with the board in front of you, to try. And then at some point I say, I'm not a strong solver. Please show the first couple of moves. And then, you know, at one point you get to the climax, and then you would want to solve that for sure, because that's, you want to see the idea.
Yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't thought of it in terms of a climax, but just in having played through so many in this book, you do kind of reach a moment where you feel like there's momentum and you can start to figure things out. Whereas at the beginning, it's quite challenging. Of course, with all quality chess books, there is likely a preview that listeners can check out online. Again, I highly recommend this book. If you're an ambitious player, I would say, probably want to be rated at least 1900 FIDE to really take this on from a training perspective. But again, there's plenty to just enjoy as you play through it. After the break, we will hear what Stefan observed from seeing how Grandmaster Sam Shanklin and others approach solving endgame studies. We'll be right back.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
And we are back. And I enjoyed the chapter Solve Like a Grandmaster, where you guys present these to a panel of strong players, including Sam Shanklin, I believe Christopher Yu, and many others. So I'm just curious how you guys went about that. Like, was, I'm assuming this was done online and done with the honor system.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. And how do you think, sorry, go ahead.
No, you go.
Oh, I was going to ask, how do you think a players like that would approach it? Like, do you think Shanklin's spending hours on these, or is he also maybe 15 minutes and then, all right, let's get on with it.
I know for a fact that how he goes about solving these, because Jakob told me this, that he looks at the starting position, then he says, it can only be this move. So I make this
looks
move.
For the most ridiculous move.
Yeah. No, not he makes a practical choice, like he was sitting in front at the board.
Okay.
And then at some point, Black there's a black surprise, and then he reacts to that. At the board, he will react to the black move that is surprising. So, in fact, a couple of these studies he failed to solve because he didn't take into consideration the black counterplay. He thought the solution was easier than it was, in fact, was. So he didn't see what black could do, but he did, but if he had been sitting at the board, he didn't. It was not necessary for him to see the black counterplay, because once the move was played, he would be able to find the refutation. So he had a very practical way of solving studies. And I think some of the other top solvers who are, you know, more trained at solving studies, they would look for the artistic point of the study from the very beginning. They will, you know, look for piece configurations that would suggest that now there's a stalemate or now there's a mate, something like that. But Sam was more practical.
That makes sense.
It must make sense.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear. And I also found it interesting that Christopher Yu, I know that he had gotten some attention for some of the studies that he has done. And I know he's a killer chess training student and so works with Grandmaster Agard frequently, but they mentioned in the book that he decided to discontinue the hobby of composing studies because it was affecting his thinking during games, which I found that fascinating.
He's an incredible calculator at the board. He can calculate lines and solving studies he does in a split second as well. Most studies, of course. It's a shame that he stopped composing, but I'm not sure if composing will affect your playing strength. It will take a time away from studying.
Right.
That would be the main thing.
Yeah, so there's the opportunity cost, but I can also imagine if you're sitting at a board, sort of as Jakob describes, where there's a bishop on g2, and you think, what if it were on g4? It's not the most helpful thought process necessarily for calculating, but maybe like Jan Timman, he can return to it in his later years.
Yeah, but maybe a good example is Kaspar Pirun from Poland. He's a 2650 grandmaster, and he takes part in these solving competitions where you not only solve studies but also helpmates and selfmates and problems that are even further removed from the over the board game of chess. And he's not taking any damage from this. He's still a very strong over the board player. So you cannot automatically say that you.
But that's solving rather than composing.
That's solving. That's true.
Yeah. I think solving it can't be bad. You know. Although I write about this in my book. There's a chapter about endgame studies, and I was emailing with Grandmaster Wojciech Miranda, author, and he's slightly against. He doesn't like the impractical studies, which I know you guys try to avoid in this book. So that brings me back to the question of curation. So of course you're drawing from, I'm sorry, can you pronounce the Dutch gentleman's name who, I have the Endgame Study database, but I don't want to mispronounce his name.
I'm not sure, but Harald van der Heijden.
Okay, yeah, that was better than I would do. So what was the process of going through? I mean, you're starting with 80,000 in-game studies and whittling it down. For how many did you end up with in the book?
1,002.
Okay, so yeah, that's a big process. How did you go about doing that?
I think it's even 95,000 now in the most recent edition of his database. And the next one will cross 100,000 for sure. But I did the initial sorting of the studies. In fact, I went by composers. I found the names of the strong composers from the past that I know, Kasparian, Kuppel, Troitsky, and I just looked through all the studies to see which positions looked game-like, really in games, not crazy positions with five bishops and all that. So in the end, I had narrowed it down to 2,000 studies, and I thought that would be enough. But then Jakob started removing the crazy ones, the one that were not really helpful for the practical players, and we ended down below 1,000, and I had to find a lot of extra studies to put in the book.
Wow! Yeah, and just. A treasure trove, an amazing amazing compilation of books. And we should say, by the way, that Harald's database, you can purchase if you have Chessbase, you can purchase it. I think it's about $50, and he just, you know, you just pay him through PayPal and he emails it to you, and it'll keep you busy for the rest of your life if you want. So
it's a PGN database. Can you be used with Chessbase? Yes.
Yeah. So worth supporting if you're interested.
Absolutely.
But I also wanted to ask you about sort of the legacy of endgame study books. You mentioned again in your Chessbase India interview that it all started for you with a book called The Chess Mysteries of the Arabian Nights. Mm-hmm. For me, the first book I think of when I think of endgame studies, one that's often recommended here on the podcast, but unfortunately, the only version that you can really get is done by a shady publisher that just kind of Xeroxes books and then sells them but the book is Domination by Kasparian. I'm curious which books were most formative for you or were you working from the database as you got deeper and deeper into endgame studies?
I have Kasparian's book, a real version, I think.
Okay.
But it wasn't and I knew my friend the friend I had some years back, he had this copy. I've been studying it maybe 20 years from today, Kasparian's book. But it's a collection of studies. It's you look at the diagram, you try to solve it, and then you see the solution. It's not a particularly inspirational work because there are no prose.
Right. And it's going to be filled with cooks compared to something like the database, right?
Yeah. I mean, Kasparian, when he died, when his obituary was written, they said he was an exceptional composer, one of the very best. Only some 50% of his studies were found to be cooked. and it's really a praise because, you know, imagine sitting there, you know, trying to compose something without a computer. I would get nowhere now.
Yeah.
Because I'm, I'm not as strong player as he is. And I must say again, Pavakov from Russia, he composed 10, 15 years without any computers at the beginning of his career, and he's still the best. Yeah. it's amazing. He's a genius, I think.
And he has a book of his studies, correct?
Yes, he has several books of his studies, actually.
Okay, so I'm guessing, I mean, beyond your book, those might be a good place for...
It's a good place to start. And The Art of the Endgame is the name of Timman's book.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a book about... it's a book, in fact, about 1 year in his life when he had decided to write the book. And when he started writing the books, he kept composing new stuff, like a maniac. So he made maybe 100 new studies for this book. And he explains the composing process and what inspired him to compose. And I think if one's looking for a major inspiration for composers, that book should be up there.
Okay. And do you have any in the non-study realm, and you know, when you were playing more OTB, did you have other favorite chess books, or what was your approach to chess study?
I'm not actually sure. The first books I had were opening books, and some classic Danish books that were never translated. So maybe Ben Larsen's The Best Games collection. That's a book I've read where I've read every word. And because he was a brilliant writer in Danish, Ben Larsen. Absolutely exceptional talent for writing and for playing chess, of course. So I'll say that was an inspiration.
Yeah. He comes up, you know, obviously Denmark has Peter Hein Nielsen and yourself, and I've interviewed amateur players from Denmark as well. And it just seems like it's impossible to overstate the legacy of Bent Larsen.
That's true.
He just... even more so than other national hero chess players, it strikes me that his name always comes up and people are always fans of his writing in addition to his chess.
Yes. Yes.
And what's...
he was such a personality, in fact.
And how popular is chess in Denmark right now? Is there any sort of echo from Magnus in the neighboring country?
I think it's not an echo from Magnus because that didn't go any further than to the border of Norway. Because but it's I think it's an echo of the YouTube influencers and the whole chess boom that is happening now. There's a lot of chess in cafes now in Copenhagen. A lot of social events where people just go and play chess. And that didn't happen 5 years ago.
And now you have Grandmaster Agard back there as well.
Yeah, that's the guy people want to meet at cafes for sure.
Of course. And I guess you since you live in the same city, you were able to work on this book together in person.
The last part of the book, when he moved back to Denmark, we worked on in person. Yeah.
And how long has this book been in the works, Stefan?
It's almost like an average study. It's three and a half years.
Wow!
I just checked our correspondence from March 2000, and that was perhaps another COVID-19 product that somehow we had this idea that now was the time to make a book of the best studies for solving.
Well, it's a fantastic resource. Highly recommend it. Again, can't stress, like, you know, you buy it once and then you can return to it for eternity, basically. Do you have any closing thoughts about the book? Anything you think people should know that we haven't mentioned?
I would say I don't mention. You mentioned someone who were not fond of. Of the artistic studies of the, you know, the studies that were not for practical usage. I don't remember the name.
Yeah, Grandmaster Miranda. Go ahead.
Okay. And I just want to say that he's right, of course, that you cannot learn chess from absurd paradoxes in a specific position, because you'll never get this position in a million years if you play over the board. But I think chess is a bit richer than just a competitive chess. And I think each person needs to build their own house of chess, where they find their own meaning with chess. And I found this corner of chess where I can actually go and discover stuff. I can go and go and find out if there's any position, any middle game positions where white needs to win. But the only way to win is to make that black and white makes 16 consecutive king moves in middle game positions. And normally I'll say, okay, this is not possible. And then I made a study that showed that it is possible. So I built this corner of the game of chess. And other people, they like the historic part of chess. Some people like to do historical research. Some people just like to go to the club to make jokes when they play Blitz. Some people like the, you know, YouTube or the influencer part of the game that is emerging now. Just incredibly rich, and studies this part of it.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And correspondence chess as well. And yeah, I mean, obviously talking about chess every week, that's one of the things I love about it, is that there are so many, you know, subgenres of chess that we can get fascinated by. And I don't think that Grandmaster Miranda, like, I don't think he's meaning to cast aspersions. I think it's just that since he's a trainer, he's coming at it from the perspective of you know, hardcore students of chess, ambitious young players in particular. Mm-hmm. He doesn't want them to go down the wrong path. And so I don't think he or most people would say, it's not that there's no place in the world for air quotes impractical studies, but that we all have to make judgments about how to spend our time. And when we're addicted to chess, it's there's never enough hours in the day. So
that's true.
So some things don't make the cut. But this has been fantastic, Stefan, for exactly the reasons you said. I've, you know, you've been on my list of people I want to interview for years, and Endgame Labyrinth is the perfect occasion to hear more about you know, the many, many hours you've spent both on this project and more broadly in creating cool puzzles. So thank you.
Thank you.
And if anyone wants to, you're on Twitter, AKA X, whatever, if anyone wants to keep up with you, is there any other method for keeping up with your work?
I would say the main block where composers meet is a Ukrainian block run by Sergei Didok, and that's a really good place to discuss studies seriously from a composing perspective.
Yeah, that reminds me. Sorry, before I let you go, I did want to ask if anyone is interested in sort of getting their feet wet, say they've never composed a study and their interest is piqued, what resources and what advice might you share?
Send the study to a tournament, basically.
Okay.
And then or email me and ask how it's done, because I'm there to reply.
Okay, great. So I will give them in. Excellent. So I will link to your Twitter, your email, and of course to the book links, both the free preview and Forward Chess and Quality Chess. And yeah, thank you again for the interview and for the book and for all of your work, Stefan.
Okay. Thank you.
Podcast Network.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere. This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.